listening to the Colorado Springs Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by the Envision Advisors at Your Castle Real Estate.
Hey, Colorado Springs. This is Jenny Bayless, and I'm here with my co-host, Chris Lopez. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing great. I'm very excited for today's interview.
Yeah. So we have Dan Habercost on with us today, and I'm super pumped to talk to him about his strategies that he's implementing. He's active in Colorado Springs. He's active in Pueblo. So kind of right up what our alley of what we're interested in learning more about. So Dan, let's just dive right back into it. Tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are, where you came from, and then we'll just kind of go right into all the real estate stuff.
Sounds good. Yeah. Jenny, Chris, thank you very much for having me. It was fun to do a local podcast here. I love the Springs. I love living here. So I thought this would be fun. But anyways, yeah, I'm originally from Ohio, actually, and stayed there until I was finishing up college. Came out here to visit my brother because he's here with his wife, and took me about a day to decide to pack my things and drive across the country. So moved to Colorado in 2018. As far as investing, I bought my first property beginning of 2018 while I was still finishing college, actually. It was a duplex, house hacked it, still own that duplex today. It's in Parma, Ohio, for anyone who's familiar with that side of the country. When I moved out here, bought another house hack up in Village 7, and that has been an awesome, awesome property. Still own that one today. And soon thereafter, I realized if I wanted to scale a portfolio of rentals, I needed to figure out how to make a substantial income, right? You can pick up a couple with the low and no money down thing, but this is a cash intensive venture. You're going to have things go wrong, you know, down payments aside, roofs are going to need replaced, sewer lines, things like that happen all the time. So you've got to have cash, or someone who invests with you has to have cash. So around that same time when I moved here, I met a guy at the local real estate group here in the Springs that I actually host now, who had been building and developing his whole life and turned into a mentor over time. And really, we just became friends and learned how to build houses from him, learned quite a bit about land. And so obviously, it sounds way more planned out in hindsight, but started a land business that today, it's just really, if you think of what wholesalers do, it's the same concept for land. And then as the deals come in, some of them I build on, some of them just flip, some of them we sell on notes, some of them we assign. So same sort of thing. But that business is what feeds the passive investing. So obviously that was a lot in a short time there, but the active business, Front Range Land, is feeding the acquisition of rental properties.
That's great. So when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that you keep all of your buy and holds, well, primarily all of your buy and holds in Colorado Springs. Can you touch on that a little bit about what your Colorado Springs portfolio looks like and why Colorado Springs? Why do you like to hold your buy and holds there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's part of it is just, I like the idea of investing where I live, but at the same time, there's a lot of people like me that are moving here. It's growing. This is one of the places Californians are going. You know, we have a lot of healthcare, we have military, we have education. There, you know, maybe I'm just justifying an irrational decision with logic in hindsight, as we all tend to do. But there are a lot of factors causing Colorado to grow and people to move here. So it makes a lot of sense. And there's such a lack of housing here. It creates opportunity with house hacking because you can rent rooms for $700-$800 a month to tenants with 800 credit scores. I know because I've been doing it for years. So I have the duplex in Ohio, and then I have four houses here in Colorado Springs, two of which are rented by the room. And it has been crazy. The house over in Village 7, I bought that in 2018, and this is going to blow your mind. I have not had a single day of vacancy. Not a single day of vacancy.
I believe it. Yeah, I believe it.
And so the tenant quality is fantastic. So, you know, we hit on this when we were talking a few weeks ago, Jenny, but all the things that people complain about in the market really create opportunity in other ways. The only reason I'm able to do that is because there's a lack of housing. So there's always a good and a bad to every market cycle or stage of the market cycle.
So Dan, what's your, oh,
Go ahead, Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
I was curious for your buy and holds here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, you have your active investing to fund mm-hmm. your long-term, I'll say retirement, you know, rental properties. Mm-hmm. What's your views, especially market like Springs, where there's high appreciation? Are you going to tap in the equity and cash out, refi and trade up, sell and trade up, or these like buy property, pay them off? Like, what's your strategy on the rental side?
Great question. So as of right now, I'm not intending to sell anything. I'm probably collectively about 60, 65% leveraged. I don't intend to change that because I spend a lot of time with older investors. And the thing that I find most frequently is they just don't lose. They're very careful. They're very conservative. And that more is what's important over the decades, as opposed to necessarily leveraging as much as you can. So I'm cautious. I already do the things I want to do every day. I don't need to take a lot of risk. So I'm very cautious and maybe overly so, but I'm not tapping any of that equity, just keeping the properties I have. They're nice houses and nice locations and slowly building. But that is a question. And it's certainly something that comes up from time to time. And I'm wondering if I am making the best decision or not there, but that's where I'm at as of now, more conservative in that regard.
So are you buying about a house a year in Colorado Springs? Is that kind of your plan for that?
No, the plan going forward, especially this last 24 months, I've really figured out how to scale my active income, and I'd like to scale my investing at the same level. So just thought I had a duplex off market under contract here, but she ended up kind of snaking me. So I've got to figure that out and get that marketing system set up to pick up the buy and holds so I can buy a few more properties this year, as opposed to just one or two a year, like I've been doing.
Awesome. And then I also wanted to touch on, you mentioned you do rent by the room strategy. That is something that we have been helping our clients to kind of understand and reel in what all is involved with that. And because it is extremely lucrative from the cash flow side of things. And that's something that a lot of people are discouraged about in the Colorado mm-hmm. Springs market, is that cash flow is really, really tight on a traditional long-term rental right now. But the rent by the room model mm-hmm. that, I mean, that completely blows that constraint, away. So it sounds like you have some that are mm-hmm. rent by the room, some that are traditional. What makes you decide to pick which strategy for that?
So the Village 7 house, just leaving it to go pick up my next house hack. It was already rented by the room. So I just put someone in the master and just left it be. And then the house I'm living in here on the southwest side, over by close to the Broadmoor, about a mile east of the Broadmoor, same sort of thing, just renting the rooms out, because there's so many split levels all throughout town, especially Village 7 and then down here. So it works really well. And at the end of the day, if you screen your tenants properly, it's really hard to go wrong when you have a house full of people with 700 plus credit scores, whose bosses tell you they're reliable, whose prior landlords tell you they're reliable. And so if you are clear on your expectations, you do your screening, that sort of thing can work. And just from, even if you're just house hacking, right, just the house you're in, so many people are afraid of that. I rented to friends when I first started, and I would much rather rent to strangers than friends in hindsight, because again, there's no personal connection there. You just are really clear with your standards and your rules and your screening. And a lot of times I don't even see them. They just go to work, come home, go to bed. So yeah, that strategy has worked very, very well here. I have a dentist renting from my basement. She had an 810 credit score, and that's just lack of housing.
Yep.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Goes to the theme of the market right now.
Yeah.
So I take it you're self-managing these room by room rentals?
Yeah. It's okay. One of the last things I need to offload, but it hasn't really taken any time. So I don't really hear from any of them much. So,
well, that's great. I mean, you got your systems down, it's working. I mean, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
I am really curious about, because I know you do some land deals. Mm-hmm. Which is an area I know very, very little about. So I always love like learning from other people. So I'd be curious to kind of hear what you're up to on there and what you're seeing in the marketplace right now from a land perspective.
Yeah, land has been good because it's just not as well known as, you know, houses or apartments. And so there's just so much less competition. It's just a very inefficient market. So again, just if you think of what a wholesaler sets up as far as their marketing system, same sort of thing, but for land. And so been buying and selling between 4 and 7, sometimes 8 parcels a month. in Pueblo West, Colorado City, did a couple out in South Fork, and getting some deals actually down in Florida now too. And Pueblo West and Colorado City have been the two markets where I've actually built. But then on top of that, it makes the cash flow far more consistent to flip a few and sell some on notes. But I stick to all infill lots. And so what I mean by that, to contrast, a lot of people in the land business go after recreational acreage, right? So they'll go out east and find areas where you can park an RV or camper or whatever, and they'll get 40, 80, 100 acre parcels. I think the largest parcel I've ever dealt with was 1.6 acres. So when I say infill, what I mean is it's within a subdivision and the lots are quote unquote shovel ready, meaning that years ago, somebody came in, took the huge tract of land, did all the work involved in subdividing it, bringing in utilities, bringing in streets and roads. And so I'm getting the lot with a lot of money, time, and effort put into it already. And so as far as building goes, it's very, very simple. And then with the housing boom and all the people moving here, if I don't want to build on it, there's lots of other people that do. So it makes it easy to flip it. And then at the same time, just the due diligence behind it is so easy with infill, because you're dealing with 10,000 or 5,000 lots that are exactly the same. So my marketing is very straightforward. All the letters have an offer price on it. And my acquisitions managers cold call. They get right to, hey, we've been buying at X price. Are you interested? So there was a lot of information there, but land has been an awesome avenue for generating income. And it's very simple and scalable and far less overhead than, you know, going the traditional route or maybe flipping houses or signing houses, as many people do.
So
are you just buying raw land?
Yeah.
Well, it's not raw because it has all the utilities and zoning and everything's done. When you say raw, you know, so.
I shouldn't say raw, it's just the undeveloped. Again, I don't know all the technical language.
Okay. Like,
no structure on there. I mean, like, would you buy a place with a, you know, old house on there, sit on it and knock it down one day? Or do you just completely buy?
I've never done that. Yeah, I've looked at some deals like that. Everything, has been undeveloped when I bought it.
Okay.
So who is selling these parcels if they've done the work of getting them zoned and utilities, which, again, I know nothing about land either. So I've only heard that getting utilities set up is just really, really difficult, especially in Colorado with water and everything. So, like, how does one have a whole subdivision set up, and then do they just, is that their business strategy? Like they get it ready and then they just subdivide it and sell off some and keep some for themselves. And then you're the next in line to.
Yeah. So this is a great question. I can give you examples. It's fun to do this on a local podcast where people know where I'm talking about. So for example, right now, if you look at the northeast side of Pueblo, not Pueblo West, Pueblo over by the college, all that land going up the hill in the right before the last big recession, there was a couple developers out of Canada. They came down, they bought it, they had it annexed into the city so that they would provide utilities to it. And then they subdivided a big portion of that land, and then the market crashed. And this is the sort of thing that happens and then leaves opportunity for those of us down the road. So yes, Jenny, you're absolutely right. A developer will come in, take huge parcels of land. They're doing this out east of the airport in Colorado Springs and Denver. They'll subdivide it, and then they'll sell off sometimes to the big developers, like, you know, Richmond or Oakwood, or sometimes they'll sell it off to mom and pop builders. Just depends how what sort of volume they're doing. So yes, that is a strategy in and of itself that's very involved and cash intensive, but I am watching some of my friends do it right now. So in the example of, let's say, Pueblo West, that was a failed subdivision from the 70s. So McCulloch, the guy that did that, he did Lake Havasu. He was just following the Army Corps engineers as they were damming up the Colorado River. He would buy the land around the reservoirs they're creating. Havasu went very well. He went and did the same thing in Pueblo West 10 or 20 years later, ended up going broke for whatever reason. The market at the time, it didn't get
what
built
an
out.
Interesting business model. That's so fascinating. Yeah. Like, very creative. Like, yeah, so fascinating.
Yeah, it is interesting. But in that case, so it didn't get built out. So here you had this big subdivision, bunch of buildings built in the 70s, but it's probably, I don't know, 15, 20% built out, just estimating. And all these lots are left with utilities. And I went down there for the first time in 2018. And I remember thinking, okay, I was looking at the pricing in Colorado Springs, which, you know, it wasn't where it is today, but it was still decently expensive. And you could still buy infill lots down there. So just ready to be built on, all utilities in place for $3,000 to $5,000. And I'm looking at the reservoir. It's 55 and sunny down there in the winter, not that far from the springs. And I'm thinking to myself, how is nobody down here? So that's a perfect example of the sort of markets I've gone after. I have a build closing in Colorado City on Monday. Same sort of thing. It's a sleepy little town even further down I-25, but there's people moving down there. So it's the same situation. That was done, I think, in the 60s. And again, didn't get built out. There wasn't enough people coming here at the time. So yeah, these failed subdivisions from years ago that are now getting built out have been excellent opportunities because someone took all the time, put all that money and effort into taking that huge chunk of raw land and subdividing. You know, I have a friend that's doing these from raw land to subdivision out east of Denver. And I think just to get 13 lots out of one parcel took him 14 months. I mean, it was a big, big process. So yeah, going after the infill stuff has been easy, I guess would be the easiest way to say it.
So when you take down these infill properties, what's the financing? Because I know, you know, buying undeveloped land is very different financing than buying a land with a house on there. Are you buying cash? Are you doing a portfolio loan?
So I've done them all cash. When I started, it was just my investors, and now it's just my cash mostly. Okay. But yeah, getting financing is harder. It's generally going to have to be private money. I know there are banks who will give you partial financing if you're going to build your own house on it. But yeah, generally speaking with land, another route to go though is owner financing, because so many people, at least in the markets I'm in, bought these lots decades ago. They've been sitting on them forever. And, you know, you could go that route or even say, hey, you know, I'm looking for investors or, you know, to get a build going, whatever, and just put it on a contract for a long period of time. With land, it tends to be less urgent, especially in the areas I am, because they've owned it for so long. So it's not a, hey, I need to move this in 3 days or 10 other wholesalers are going to be calling this guy.
So for someone wanting to get into like land and that, like, where would you say, like, give them a starting point? Because this is, I always try to go back to someone sitting here saying, hey, I like that idea. Where should they start learning more about this?
Well, I would go find some sort of subject matter expert in everything I'm doing. More and more, I'm realizing a lot of things I've done would have been easier if I just found someone who already knew what I wanted to know. And so if you have a market identified that could just be a realtor in that market who has half the land listings or a bunch of the land listings, and talk to them, because what you need to know right off the bat, you need to figure out, okay, what's the utility situation? You know, are the utilities at the lot? Is it a matter of septic and well? Do I need water rights, right? You're going to need to talk to someone who knows your area, because there's nuances and subtleties of every market. You know, for example, what's going on in Fountain? They're completely out of water taps down there. So, you know, I had a friend who owned a bunch of land down there, and he wrote it off as being worth nothing on his books, you know? So that sort of thing is important. And with anything, if you want to learn, find the person that knows, whether you're paying them or working for them, or they're a realtor you can give business to, whatever, and learn from them, provide value and learn from them.
That, I mean, that's timeless and great advice.
Can we talk a little bit about water?
Yes.
I know we were talking a little bit before we started the podcast, but I love that you just mentioned the Fountain issue. So Fountain is just south of Colorado Springs. It's something that I've been kind of keeping my eye on, because I think it will push people down into Pueblo proper. And then we'll talk about Pueblo West. But like you said, you know, Fountain said no more, so they can't build anymore for, for right now, you know, in between Colorado Springs and Pueblo, essentially. So, you know, water is such a sticky issue in Colorado. And I know that you were talking earlier about Pueblo West and the water issues there. Can you go into that a little bit? And then what do you know about Pueblo proper water also?
Okay. I'm trying to bookmark. There's a lot of things I want to hit on. And one being just in general, guys, be ready, because it sounds so easy when we talk on podcasts, right? It sounds like the day-to-day is great. Everything goes well. So let me frame this for you guys. I think 7 lots I had closed on in Pueblo West in January. I was coming home from a trip to Florida. I had a layover in Washington, D.C. And when I land, and you know, you get all the texts when you get service again, I have all these texts. Hey, Dan, call me. You got to hear about this. Oh, hey, my acquisitions manager's telling me they're not interested in the lot anymore. I didn't know what was going on. Turns out there's a moratorium on new build permits and water taps in Pueblo West, where I have most of my land, until March the 14th. And so that was a big kick in the teeth, guys. And no matter what business you're in, you are going to get kicked in the teeth. That is one thing I can assure you. And so you better have a strong motivator as to why you're doing this or you'll give up. So I wanted to make that point because I can go over story after story after story of that sort of thing happening. Now, as I understand it, they came out with an article last week. It looks like Pueblo West has made a deal with Pueblo proper. They have enough water to provide a decent amount of taps. I don't remember the number off the top of my head per year. And I think all we're waiting on at this point is how many they're going to allocate per unit of time and what they're going to charge for each tap. They're going to increase the cost quite a bit. But they were a little bit more forward thinking than some other places. And they didn't wait till they're at zero and just say, oh, shoot, they're doing some planning. So we should have more information in March. You know, I still have a lot there that's closing today. So a lot of the sentiment is positive from people who live down there that the problem will be solved. But that's where we're at. And that's frustrating. I have over $100,000 sitting down there in lots. So, you know, that's a decent chunk of cash. So be ready for that sort of thing in business, guys, because no matter where you're or what you're in, that's going to happen. Now, as far as Pueblo proper, I have done no building over there. So I really can't tell you what the situation is. I know my markets and that's about it. So unfortunately, I can't be as much of a help there. So I think I hit on everything you asked me there. I'm not sure if I did or not.
Yeah. So with the tap restrictions for the properties that you have chosen to build on, and I assume you had the taps turned on, or I don't really even know the process to that. Does that make your built homes more valuable because the taps are on?
So that's an excellent question. For one of the builds I have going, I got the permit water tap on that a few days before they did the moratorium. So I barely got it in. So yes, I was just having this conversation yesterday with my realtor on this because we have it listed at 385 and the comps support that. But with the further restriction on supply, I think we can sell it for closer to 400. So I'm probably going to bump the price up. It's so dynamic. It's so hard to know what it's actually going to sell for. But I think you're right in that it is going to just push up prices even further. And for anyone that is unfamiliar with Pueblo West, when I was down there before the pandemic, we'd build a simple 3-2, 13, 66, 1400 square foot house for about 190, sell it for about 250. Great, great little projects. Nowadays, that house, this one's slightly larger. It's 1490, so 120 some square foot bigger. It looks like it's going to sell somewhere between 385 and 400. So it's just nuts what is going on down there. Yeah. Yeah. And granted, the basis
is higher. What about the build cost? How much does that increase, though?
Yeah,
the price has gone up. Has the build cost gone up proportionally? Hopefully not as much?
Not proportionally. There's going to be some, like, so for Cabaret, the one I'm going by the fire station I just told you about, there should be between a number of factors I'm still unclear on. Some of the labor costs are still unclear, but there should be 75 to 85, maybe 90 in that one profit. So
okay,
it's a decent build. But yeah. So to your point, Jenny, I do believe it's just going to further push prices up down there.
Yeah, I know I've had this conversation with other investors that have asked about the water restriction and what impact that has on Colorado real estate. And I mean, I could be completely wrong, you know, and I'm willing to say that. But I imagine it would just further constrain the supply that we already have versus the demand of people wanting to live here still. If there's only so many houses that can be built due to water levels, like, what you have is what you got. That's kind of how I see that.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out. You know, I haven't done anything with building Colorado Springs. I'm not sure how much water that we have up here, but and of course, you know, the way we could have a couple good years and the lakes and rivers could fill back up, but it is interesting to see how this plays out because this whole side of the country is in a drought and Colorado is the only, at least in the continental United States, state where all the water flows out and none flows in. So there's always lawsuits with the surrounding states about water rights and that sort of thing too. So it's a constant battle.
So what makes you decide between what you're going to do to the lot, wholesale, build, put on a note, and then also have you kept any of your builds as rental properties for yourself?
So I have not kept any as rental properties yet. A single family, the numbers aren't necessarily great down there. Granted, in the last 6 months, rents in Pueblo has skyrocketed, even more so than the Springs. So it's starting to potentially make sense. Just build a duplex down there and keep it. Yeah. but yeah, Anyways, so as far as making the decision, it just depends. You know, if I'm going to build, I want it to be 100% flat between established houses, you know, the ideal property. So just taking the best ones to build on, flipping the others. And then as far as the notes, sometimes that's just depending on what offers we get, or if my basis is low enough and I can get, you know, 100% of the cash out and then just have all the profit on a note, that is ideal. So sometimes just what the basis is depends, whether it's a cash or a note sale. But that sometimes just is determined by the market.
Before we hop off here, I want to go down kind of one other line about the active business you built, but I don't want to pivot from water until you're ready, Jenny.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Because one of the things here, I know, like, you know, from what you said earlier, you know, you've built a active business that's increased your cash flow so you can go passive with your money. And, you know, this is a question I get a lot. I know Jenny does as well. And for a lot of like investors out there, they're always trying to figure out how to, you know, either get more cash to go out there and, you know, buy more properties or set up some type of like, you know, marketing sales process to find properties at a discount. But I know when I started, I did not realize or appreciate how much time it took to go out there and build an active business. I think a lot of people don't have it out there as well. Can you kind of tell us a little of your story, what your staff, what your overhead, what your operations look like to go out there? And hey, you're able to find these good deals that for your buy box, but there's more than just you working part-time on this, it sounds like. So can you paint us a picture as to what it takes?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. And so you gotta have a strong enough motivator to just deal with all the crap you're gonna have to deal with, whether you're gonna be a broker, or get a land business going, or start flipping. So you need to be really clear on why you're doing this first, or you're just gonna give up. I assure you that. So with the land business, it's really, really simple at this point. I have an acquisitions manager here. I have one who's been helping me in Texas as well. I'm hiring another VA here, because the one in Texas looks like he's getting a little too busy. And then she handles all of the acquisitions, the dispositions.
This is your acquisitions manager?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and this is a full-time person?
No, nope. She probably works, gosh, I'd have to look, somewhere 15 to 20 hours a week. Okay. Yep, because, guys, it's so much simpler with land. There's no due diligence. You look at the map and we know our markets. We know if it has utilities. We know, there's almost no due diligence. You know, in 30 seconds, you don't ever have to go there. It's very transactional with buyers. There's no rapport. I mean, I did this myself before. I'm just going to disagree with a lot of what I hear. I did probably the first 30 or 40 land deals myself. I'd have to go back and look at my notes before I hired anyone. And most of those conversations, they just wanted to know I wasn't going to scam them. So all I do is, oh, here's the title agent. Talk to them. Like, no rapport. Just, can you close? Yep. Short, quick conversations. So because it's such a simple asset, it really reduces the time involved in this. So anyway, she takes all the inbound leads. She coordinates the title company. We have, don't even get me started on title companies. I think I've used 7 or 8 different ones and I have yet to be not disappointed. But anyways, a bunch of different title companies in town. And then I have different realtors who will sell the land for me. I have a couple different general contractors I've used to do the builds, and then same realtors that'll sell the builds. So it's really, really simple. She's getting a little bit overwhelmed, and we're moving into the Florida market I was talking about earlier. So that's why I'm getting this other VA going 20 hours a week. But the overhead's really minimal. I've been, up until this point, my cost per deal has been right around the $150 to $200 mark. Wow. So yeah. Well, again, that's land. And I've done 70 some deals in the last 2.5 years total, really in the last 2 that I've really buckled down. Anyways, yeah, it's a very, very simple business. And she has placed a couple of my tenants for me and helped me with that too, just because she wanted to learn. So that's about it as of now.
All right. That's very insightful. And I think it just goes to, you know, to peel back this onion a little bit, is that you found an inefficiency in the market. Mm-hmm. You found where there's less, you know, eyeballs and people trying to buy this asset class in this location, and you built a business plan around it. Like, you did it yourself, and now you've built a business around it. And I just want to highlight that, because to go out there and have success like that, you just have to be very intentional, and you are starting a business. That's not just something you do as like a part-time hobby, but it's a business, right?
Yes, absolutely. I have all my numbers tracked. You know, I know how many mailers I'm sending, which batches got deals, which didn't, different types of mailers, all that I track very carefully. I try and have clear KPIs in that regard. working on narrowing down the numbers on cold calling too. Just haven't really done it at a significant enough volume to truly have regressed to the mean there on that. So working on that too. But that's a great point, Chris. Whatever it is that you're doing, it can't be, I send out a few mailers and hope I get a deal. You got to be consistent, yeah, intentional, and relentless in everything you do. Some of the best deals we've gotten, she's followed up 20 or 30 times. I'm not exaggerating at all. So to be clear, these are people that responded to the mailers and said they had interest. It wasn't like we're harassing people. It's like, got a voicemail that says, hey, yeah, I think I want to sell. And then they disappeared. I tell her, you just keep calling until they respond or tell us to go away. And that has gotten us a lot of deals.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a very, you know, I learned sales, and yeah, I was taught was you follow up until they buy or die was basically like one.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Until they either buy from me and say, hey, I don't want it. Like, that was a very dramatic thing, but it's that's right. The fortune of the follow up. And for a lot of these things, it's not, it's not the first phone call. It's not the 10th. It is the 20th or 30th touch point on there. And it takes persistence. Yeah, so thank you. Absolutely. I'm really glad you shared that. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. In everything, following up, and it's always when you're about to give up that things come through.
Yes.
So I wanted to touch on this as well, because we kind of went on a tangent when we were chatting earlier. So what would you tell people that want to invest in buy and holds in Colorado Springs when they say, oh, there's just no cash flow, there's no deals, there's no this, no that? What do you have to say to investors in that case?
Okay, I'll be gentle. There are deals, there is cash flow. And to the other point, which I think you might have been, we didn't necessarily say outright there, but everyone's scared about the market. Well, I remember before I bought my first property in 2018, well, I was positive we were at the top of the market when I bought that duplex or that, you know, that first house here. Well, obviously it's going to crash tomorrow and I'm going to lose, you know, quite a bit of equity, but I was planning for the long term, so it's okay. So that Village 7 house that I bought for $275 in 2018 was obviously at the top of the market. So to your point, Jenny, if you're planning for the long term, number one, you're investing for the long term, and you are conservative in your own finances and you are stable in your own finances, then absolutely I would invest now. As far as finding deals, they are absolutely out there. I bought a number myself. This last property I picked up was a 3% owner carry deal. It's about 60 in equity in it too. After buying it, 100% seller financed at 3%. This happens every day. And if you're not willing to go direct to seller, which is okay, maybe you have a good job, you enjoy your job, then get on the wholesalers list or go the house hacking route. It's really hard to go wrong house hacking. I mean, even if you just take one of the split levels and rent out the basement or something, I would make sure you are buying real estate for the long term, because we're printing money like crazy. People are like crazy. I just have a really hard time, unless there's some sort of black swan or severe government intervention. I don't see this dynamic we're in right now changing dramatically anytime soon. There are deals and there is cash flow. You just have to be persistent about it. I just watched a friend buy a duplex on the market and it cash flowed. That one was in Pueblo, but nonetheless, I've seen people do it up here too. So you just have to, just like we were just talking about with land, you have to be consistent and intentional. It can't be you look for a couple weeks, you make a few offers and you give up, or a couple months. It has to be consistency over the long term will yield you the result you want. Oh, one more thought too. You got to have your buy box. It can't just be a deal. Oh, I want a deal, right? You need to know, this is what I'm trying to accomplish. You know, I like these zip codes and, you know, just a house or a quad or whatever it might be. Be very intentional in what you're going after, because again, you might be able to get something through your network if everyone knows what you're looking for. You never know where the deal is going to come from, but consistency, intentionality, and clarity are very, very important, really with any goal, but this included.
I think that's Chris's pet peeve, is when someone comes to him and says, I want a deal. With no specifics.
And it's, which I'm fine with, because, you know, especially for new investors, we, you know, part of our job is help them figure out what their strategy is and, you know, how and if that works in the current marketplace. But yeah, you're right. You can't just say, oh, I want a good deal. I want a good deal. I want a good deal. Mm-hmm. All three of our definitions of a good deal are very, very different right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And very different. And it's not right or wrong. It's just you're doing your thing. Jenny's doing her thing. I'm doing my thing. And a good deal of me is probably not a good deal to you, or vice versa. Someone brings me a land deal right now. I'm like, I don't want that. I don't know how good it is. Yeah. I don't understand that. Put it over the Bitcoin. I'm not touching it right now.
Yeah.
But you know, that's my current where I'm at, where you'd be like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah, I'll buy it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's great advice, is, you know, just everyone out there remember, like, it's okay to not know what a good deal is, but as you talk to your mentor, your partners, your realtors, whoever your professionals are, work towards defining that buy box.
Yes.
Because if you don't know what it is and you can't clearly communicate to others, guess what? Mm-hmm. No one brings it to you. And I've had very bad luck with unicorns and rainbows in my investing career over the year.
Yeah.
So if I can't tell someone, it doesn't magically appear, you know?
Yes. Yeah. That's such a good point. I love the way they always put it on Bigger Pockets. I'll definitely give them a shout out here, where they say, oh, well, how many offers did you make this week? Oh, you didn't make any offers. Okay. Well, how many leads did you have? Oh, you didn't have any leads? Okay, there's your problem. What do you need to build out? Even if it's just realtors or wholesalers sending you leads, you have to be getting in leads, making offers on them, and then eventually you'll buy some, and you do it at volume, and eventually you'll know how many leads you have to get and offers you have to make in order to buy a property. So, I mean, that is, it's really that simple, guys. I think for a lot of people, it's just their reason for wanting to invest isn't strong enough. They don't have enough motivation to go do the difficult things involved in getting that set up. Even if it is just talking to realtors or talking to wholesalers, you know, that's a bit easier than going direct to seller, but it still takes time and effort. So you've got to be committed. And then once you're committed, you set up your funnel and you say, okay, well, how many offers did I make this week? Or how many leads did I get in? You got to have a funnel of leads coming in.
Yeah. And I think that's why real estate historically yields a better return than other investments that are actually passive, because, you know, I would not consider real estate passive. So, you know, it's just, yeah, are you willing to put in the extra work to get a little bit extra return from
it? Yeah. Well, that's what I love about real estate. If you say, oh, real estate or stocks, they're not comparable. I mean, I guess from the perspective of opportunity cost, they have to be, because we're all limited with the funds we have, but they're completely different. I see real estate as a flexible asset where I can go get absurdly high returns over and over and over again in very short periods of time, but it's active, as opposed to, you know, stocks or many other investment routes where it is passive, but you make very little money on it. So that's what I like about real estate, is it's scalable to the extreme degree, to the exponential degree in a short period of time.
So I've got all my questions asked. Jenny, I know you had a list. What other items do you want to pick here from Dan's brain?
Oh, man. I feel like we could probably talk for days and days and days. I mean, Dan, you're just so knowledgeable on a different, you know, a wide variety of different real estate techniques and strategies, which, you know, we really appreciate. I guess, you know, not to go down any more rabbit holes right now, what would you say is your biggest piece of advice that you haven't given yet during this interview? Okay,
that I haven't given? I've touched on a couple really key things, man.
Biggest mistake that you've learned from. Maybe we'll go.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Yeah. Biggest mistakes, probably in every instance, whether it was building houses or rehabbing houses, was contractors. Biggest mistakes I've made is contractors, and just not screening them thoroughly enough. I tend to be more the personality. I don't get analysis paralysis. I jump into things too quickly. So I've made that mistake with contractors a number of times. So guys, double, triple check your contractors. Make sure you can see examples of successful work, that people you trust ideally are telling you, hey, they've done work for me, they've been great, good reviews online, good references. Double, triple check your contractors, because it just can cause a massive amount of headache if you don't. And I've stabbed myself in the foot a number of times hiring the wrong contractors, both for new builds and for rehabs. Other than that, I just want to hit on again, guys, it will be difficult. There will be things that go very wrong, like the story I just told you with water, or I can tell you contractor stories. My contractor got arrested in the middle of doing this last project with the entire front yard excavated water and sewer line half replaced in a small residential neighborhood with dirt pouring into the neighbors, dirt pouring into the street, and he gets arrested. So these things are going to happen, and you're going to have to be able to calmly address them. But it is worth it, because a few years into this business, and suddenly you wake up every day and you decide what you do, and your priorities are your priorities, and you're not taking on someone else's. So it's absolutely worth it. But if you don't have a clear enough why, a strong enough emotional driver, you're going to give up and you're not going to do it. You're just going to say, oh, there's no deals. Well, sure, there's no deals if you're not doing anything. It's like saying you want to lose weight and then eating like crap every day and not going to the gym. It's the same sort of thing. So that would probably be the other thing. You, as cliche as it is, you do need a solid, strong why, or you're not going to do it.
That is always a great thing to focus on, and a reminder out there is have that clear why, have that goal, have the vision, because times get tough, you know, and you always have to know that goal you're working towards. So, Dan, this has been a great episode. I learned a lot, especially with land and water. So thank you. How can people get to know about you more, what you're up to, and just kind of get plugged into your world?
Sure. Yeah. Just Dan Habercost, Instagram, Facebook, and not very creative. So Dan Habercost, the website, just outlining deals and details of the things I'm working on, that sort of thing. You'll get lots of pictures of the mountains and then deals I'm doing if you go on my Facebook or Instagram.
I'll say you're not very creative, but you also have a unique name. And this comes from with a very unique name where I can't say go to Chris Lopez. So I love it. I'm slightly jealous, but I totally get it because it works. And of course, we're going to put all those, we'll put those links to show notes for people listening and watching. Go there or just go to show notes. Click it over, get plugged into Dan. Dan, thanks so much, man. This was fantastic.
Yeah, thank you guys. Chris, Jenny, this was fun.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye, everyone.